Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, I want to remind everyone that we Zoom the day before, so we will not be talking about what happens on Tuesday night at the convention because we're going to be Zooming before that. But how we begin our show. We begin our show every single day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. He is an immigrant. He is brilliant. He is a patriot. He speaks truth to power. And he told his father not to worry, that it would be all right. And what we've come to learn is that it was not all right. Not all right for him, not all right for his twin brother, frankly, not all right for the United States. That's why you have to exercise the franchise in November of 2020 with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman ringing in your ears. Now, the testimony.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I decided I wanted to talk to a bunch of professors. I wanted to talk about the reopening of school, and I also wanted to talk to two professors who I know would be paying a lot of attention to the first day of the Democratic Convention. So as a result, who did I reach out to? I reached out to a professor from North Carolina State, Stephen Green. He teaches political science. Welcome back to the program, Stephen. How are you?
Always great to be here, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. And a person who's become a friend, a real friend. Sorry, Stephen, I don't get to North Carolina that often. But Val Endres is a professor of political communications at Rhode Island College. She's actually schlepped me down to RIC so I can actually speak. And I know, too, that she has been thinking a lot about both the college opening story, which both of you have to, because it's personal for you. It's about your students, it's about your life, it's about your family, and it's about how we're going to proceed going forward. So welcome to the program, Val Endres.
Great to be here, Arnie.
Thank you. So before we do this, I'm going to take a point of personal privilege. So unlike you guys, we have a division of the University of New Hampshire in Concord. It's the law school. But the law school does not have a dorm. We are the dorm. So they are really embedded in the community, all right? And I have a young Pakistani who is going into her second year at UNH Law. And I posted something on my Facebook page, which has gotten hundreds of reactions, which is just sort of shocking to me. But I wanted to sort of read what I posted because in a lot of ways it sets the stage for what we're going to be talking about. It also makes it personal for me because just yesterday, Monday, two of my new 1Ls, the first year law students, arrived, and we're both excited and we're all terrified. So just to let you know. And here's what I wrote. UNH Law School has no dorm, but families around Concord open their doors and share their homes with future lawyers. It makes the school more rooted in the community than most academic institutions. I've been sharing my home with students since 2011 or 2012. I know we started before Marty died in 2013. I have grieved the loss of a spouse, but with each passing year, this house breathes new life into my world. Tuskeen moved in a year ago. She arrived from Pakistan to begin her adventure as a first-year law student. I know she got more than she could have imagined, given the chaos of these last couple of months. But if anyone has shown a level of maturity, acceptance, curiosity, and patience, it is Tuskeen. The law school is lucky to have her as part of their academic community, and I'm even luckier that she showed up at my door. The next 2 years are hard to imagine, but I am glad that we have each other as the world, the pandemic, the chaos of a presidential election bring about a basket of challenges that will change our lives forever. Happy 1 year, Tuskegee. P.S. Both of us are on pins as needles as new law students arrive this weekend. The majority leader's house is getting ready for a reset. And that's what I wrote about my young law student that lives with me. And now we have two Ryans that are living with us. So we have two young men and we have Tuskegee. So I'm really glad you're here, Stephen, because everyone has been talking about what happened at UNC. I mean, it has made national news. It's made international news. I'm reading it in like the China Post. My daughter called me from Shanghai going, what the hell are these colleges thinking? And part of me is almost grateful that there isn't a dorm at UNH, because in a lot of ways, they have to be part of the community, which means we sort of have to, we eye them. We let them know that they're coming home to us. They don't have to, they don't congregate the way they do at a dorm. So in a lot of ways, UNH Law School is maybe luckier than UNC, maybe luckier than Rhode Island College, maybe luckier than North Carolina State. But everybody wants it to work. Do the students understand what working means? Because it sounds like they don't get what a pandemic is, Steve.
It's hard. They have 20-year-old brains, you know? We know science about 20-year-old brains and how they work, and that they have the as good a cognitive power as they ever will have, but the wisdom, the judgment is just literally not fully formed yet. And it's really, really hard to just expect them to behave as if it is. And so with anything, you have to put, you know, the structures in place to help people be their best selves, which is really hard to do. And you know, I was talking it over with an NC State colleague today, and I think UNH Law School will be fine. I think where you have, you know, campuses and situations and offices and classrooms run by fully wise adults that are implementing all these protocols and standards, you can actually keep the spread very limited. But there's so little you can do when you have students in their own living situations in dorms and fraternities and sororities going to parties off campus. And, you know, I think that's seemed very much with UNC seems to be the case where all this transmission's been happening.
So let me say something, Val. So what you just said about their 20-year-old brains, and that we know this. So wait a minute. Did they not do tabletop exercises, Val? Did they not plan at, you know, UNC is a brilliant institution. It's one of the three in the triangle, you know, Duke and UNC. I mean, I'm thinking, what the hell is going on? If they know they're dealing with 20-year-old brains, they know how they're going to behave, then I think was this wishful thinking on their part? Did they think that these kids had matured, that the pandemic had slapped some reason into them? And yet when you looked at pictures from Georgia and you looked at pictures from Texas and I mean, everything was suggesting that the 20-year-old brain wasn't learning very much pretty quickly. And that's where I'm trying to figure out how do colleges approach this when they know that they can put all the protocols in place, but how do you create a level of maturity when these kids are at a point where somehow they've also been told, unfortunately, by Donald Trump and even by the media that, you know, while they may bring it home and they may contract it, they will survive it. And so they figure, what's the risk? They're not going home to grandma. They're going home to their roommate and they're going to survive too. So they've sort of done the calculus. You know, it's not mom. It's not dad. It's not grandma. It's grandma. It's Bobby. So Bobby will survive. I mean, this is how they're thinking. But this is not the right way to think.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that are going on here. One is that a lot of faculty weren't part of this decision, that it was a financial decision rather than a safety decision. I think the second thing that's going on is that administrators had assumed by this point that there would be adequate testing, that they would have the money and the opportunity to shore up the ventilation systems, and that they would have a procedure for temperature checks and things of this sort. So part of it is the lack of response that we've had from the federal government and states who are strapped for cash and even with CARES money can't do it. And I think there's a lack of faculty input into this. I mean, Rhode Island College was very lucky that we were one of the first in the Northeast to go online. And the reason that we did is that we have a lot of first generation students who are essential workers. And so we could read the handwriting on the wall. And we also know that Rhode Island is frequently strapped for cash. And so that played into that decision as well. And I think part of it is like what Steve was saying, all you have to do is ask faculty about adolescent brains. And they do believe that they're going to live forever. And putting these protocols in place for them, they have a hierarchy of needs. And one of those needs is to socialize and get to know other people. You bring them on campus and you cannot stop them from doing that. And so I think it's a confluence of factors that cause colleges and universities. And I would predict by October, we're going to see most of them shut down. I don't believe that we can adhere to protocols that are going to keep people safe. All it takes is one person with COVID in the classroom and it shuts down the classroom. Right. And so if you think about the logistics of that, it just doesn't work.
So Stephen, so as I'm thinking, what is North Carolina State going to do? So you hear Rhode Island College is going to be doing it online. They have a really interesting clientele too. So you knew who you served, and it wasn't just their age; it was their demographic. It's where they live. It's who they work with, and yet I don't know what the demographic is for North Carolina State, but at the same time, you're looking at UNC. Have you already opened yet? Are you following UNC? Are you going, uh-oh? Like, how is everyone making the phone chain and going, okay, we're going to close, right? We're not going to open, right? What's happening?
Well, I was in class with 25 math students myself 2 hours ago. So we are going with, it's mostly online, but some hybrid, some fully in person with those faculty who were willing and wanted to do so.
And how are you conducting class? So tell me, what is a class like with Stephen Green? Is it an online class that you're doing? Or
I'm there in a room. I'm there in a room with up to 36, though I have number quarantining today, students in a room that's at half capacity with the ventilation properly adjusted. That, let me tell you, I got the assurance from the vice provost for facilities and have brought in my own air quality meter with me. But everybody wearing a mask, sanitizer, everything, shall we say, that you can do has been put in place. So, right, and there's these nice risk calculators. The people at Duke put together this great risk calculator, which suggests my risk for the semester is roughly 2%. I will take it. But it's what those students are doing, not in my classroom. We're not going to my building to get some sort of paperwork or something.
And have you had a conversation with them about that? I mean, having watched what happened with UNC, we now hear that Brown is going to be delaying. You mentioned this, Val, before we went on the air, that Brown had said they were going to open up. Now they're delaying till, I guess, October. But was this sobering for them to see what happened at UNC? And is that sort of said to them, wait a minute, is it worth having that party? Is it worth having that beer with my friends? Maybe not. Have you had that conversation with them?
I mentioned it. I was actually expecting them to bring it up in class, and they didn't. But, I can't imagine that. I mean, North Carolina State and UNC, we're just a few miles apart, practically. I cannot imagine that it's not sobering for them. And I can only hope. Again, it's the 20-year-old brain, but still, this is a big shock to the system. And this is big, big news around here, especially and for college students. Okay. And, if, let's just say, I think UNC shutting down early, so dramatically, reduces the likelihood that NC State will, we'll see. But, if that doesn't get through to these students, then obviously nothing will, but, we'll see.
See, you know what I'm thinking? This sounds crazy, but I keep thinking that, you used to get, you would enlist or you would, get your lottery number and you would go into the military at age 17 or age 18 and all the responsibilities you have when you serve in the Army or the Navy and whatever. And in a lot of ways, I kind of want to like slap these kids around and say, you're in the pandemic now, as opposed to you're in the Army now. You're in the pandemic now. And this is about protecting your country as much as it is about protecting you. And I want to read them that kind of riot act and say, I'm not asking you to slap an Uzi on. I'm not telling you that you got to wake up at like 5 a.m. I'm not having you do military exercises. But in a lot of ways, you are doing something that really reflects how you protect your nation. And I don't think anyone's ever actually talked to students about this. It's all about sort of through the lens of academics, but in the end, it's not. We were talking about the convention, okay? And that I saw a poll that Donald Trump does much better in the economy, like by 10 points than Biden, but Biden does better basically on absolutely everything else. But what I said to someone is, has anyone explained to people that if you don't deal with the pandemic and the health, you're not gonna have an economy? If you don't deal with the pandemic and the health, you're not gonna have a school. If you don't, I mean, it's like they don't get it. This is like at the core of everything, Val. And yet nobody has really kind of said to them, you don't fix this, sweetheart, and nothing happens. And that has to be sobering for students as well.
Well, I think that part of it is, I'm going back to the adolescent brain again, but you can't have an economy in which all the temptations are in place, so that you have sorority houses and fraternity houses, and you have parties, and you have bars open. And part of it is that community spread that comes from off-campus partying or the liquor stores, you know, that get their livelihood from students, and the bars that get their livelihood from students. So there's that push-pull that's going on there in each one of those college towns. They know that they should shut down some of this access that leads to excessive socialization in a pandemic, but economically they don't believe that they can. And so I'm not worried about Steve in the classroom and their behavior in the classroom. Yeah. I'm worried about what happens in after hours. And by the very fact that you have brought them to campus, that's the reason for them to socialize. That's why they're there, as opposed to taking it remotely. So I don't know how, quite frankly, how this works.
So Stephen, just before we sort of switch to the Democratic convention, how much input did you have, other than maybe writing your obituary? I've been hearing about lots of teachers who are like writing notes to their children and writing. I mean, not that the 2% is something that you, the risk you have, but I'm thinking about the custodians. What's their risk? I'm thinking about the police, that, you know, what's their risk? Because they're going to be brought into situations where you can't like separate them in a classroom that's only half full with whatever. You are at a 2%, but the rest of the folks that are not professors or adjuncts, they may not have that luxury.
Well, you know, the administration, they took feedback, shall we say, but I mean, it was very clear that they have a series of incentives coming from the Board of Governors, the financial incentives, and that's all pushing very strongly, you know, towards being open and in person. And, you know, from what I've seen, they have been trying to be very accommodating for people who have health concerns and whatnot. But, you know, obviously that's going to put people in positions they don't want to be in, and that puts them at risk. Again, I voluntarily undertook this, but I'm sure there's people who didn't.
So before I go, so Val, I'm listening to the two of you, I keep thinking that we're at a place right now where I keep saying we should have had a gap year. And maybe what the federal government should have done is write a check and say, you know what, this is the pandemic year. This is not, you're not going to matriculate, you're not going to go from here to here. This is the pandemic year. And you can do some creative things, but it may not necessarily be within a classroom setting or your traditional academic setting, because in the end, we have to get through this. And the way we get through this is we get through this together. And I understand that UNC is, you know, needs the money, and the North Carolina and your chancellors are worried about this, but in the end, it might cost you more. I mean, am I wrong here? But the open and shut, that ain't cheap, Val. That's gotta be at least a semester's worth of money.
And part of the motivation was that Rick simply could not afford it. But I will say that faculty had at Rick a great deal of input from the very beginning. Good. And maybe they made the mistake by asking faculty, but they did. And so we had a lot to say about this, but the finances simply did not add up that they were able to do this. And we had talked before about expanding AmeriCorps, because that kind of lived experience for them and bringing that back into the classroom can only enrich them in a lot of different ways. And I think that part of the reason is that colleges and universities are sort of pretending as if this is an obstacle to be overcome. And as I tell my students, this is a once in a century or once in a lifetime, hopefully, event. And we can't outmaneuver it. You know, that there are certain
can't outrun it.
That we simply cannot do during this time as much as we want to. And I think that attitude, and I think, again, I'm going to bring politics into that, with a federal government that's pretending as if this problem is over, or it's just going to go away, only feeds into that notion that this is a temporary inconvenience for people.
So the Chan School of Public Health at Harvard has, the FDA has just approved the saliva test with the piece of paper. And what the Chan School suggested, one of the doctors wrote, he said, if we did those saliva tests every single day, it would be the equivalent of a vaccine. It would be the equivalent of a vaccine. And while the accuracy is not 90% or 80%, it may be 50, 60, 70, whatever. But if you do it every day, you actually are able to sort of get the kind of information. So in a funny way, there were solutions. They may not have been there when they wanted to open August 15th, Steve, or they wanted to open September 2nd, but they are over the horizon. And they're over the horizon, which both addresses safety, science. You know, they're not invasive. Most 99% of the people would probably prefer to do a saliva test and get a vaccine because they trust the saliva test. So in a funny way, what's missing is patience. Everybody wants to return to normal at a time when nothing is normal and they don't have the ability to wait. And I think waiting in this situation would actually benefit everyone, not only their health, but it would actually benefit the university, Stephen.
I'm impatient, but you know, the saliva test was approved because I've turned myself, I like to call myself an expert armchair epidemiologist, was a lot better than the nasopharyngeal swab, but not the one that's like your home pregnancy test that you can just easily do yourself every day for a dollar a day. That better be coming, and that absolutely will change the world. But you know, I'm impatient because you know what? We could have had this. If we had like real political leadership, as we all know what it looks like and what it doesn't, people would have been banging heads to make this stuff happening. I really think that if Hillary Clinton had been president, we would have had these little paper strips. Honestly, I think we would have crushed this way more. But if we didn't, we would have had these paper strips out for everybody a month ago, that we would have totally devoted the resources, the scientific resources of this country to, that are amazing. Science has just been kicking butt during this whole thing. The only thing holding it back is the fact that we are not putting the full power of government behind it like a, you know, reasonable government would. And so that's why I'm impatient.
No. I understand you're impatient. But it's not just, I mean, it's Donald Trump. It's all the governors. It's everyone who thinks that they have to somehow genuflect to Donald Trump, that if you embrace testing, you're evil. You know, Donald Trump still wants everyone to be on the boat off the coast of the United States. So therefore, we'll have to count those numbers. I mean, it's just mind blowing. But I think you're right. And yet I think at this point in time, that's where the opportunity comes. And that's where I want to get to the Democratic convention. So reactions to last night are interesting. I thought the most powerful thing of last night was the former Republican who's voting for Joe Biden, whose father died from COVID, and said that basically his only pre-existing condition was that he believed. She uttered those words. I immediately went to my Twitter feed. I mean, like immediately. And I'm like, that is the essence of tonight right there. And Val, I mean, everything else was there were some really good speakers, but that sort of nailed it for me. Donald Trump is a pre-existing condition. I mean, that is like, it is what it is. What a line.
Yes.
What a line.
To quote both
Trump and Michelle.
Michelle Obama. I thought it was a pretty amazing night in a lot of ways because it did what we needed to have done on the first night of a convention. Rather than other than Bernie, there wasn't a lot of talk about policy, but there was a lot of talk about leadership through empathy and the values of courage and understanding each other and the golden rule. And all of those things. So I think I think in some ways it was a very calming convention for the first day because it allowed people to think about values in a way we haven't been able to. And what we have done for the last 3.5 years, going on 4 years, is simply react and respond in anger to Donald Trump. And I think that this was a different way. And I think that Michelle Obama's speech was intentional in that way, to start getting us to think about democratic values rather than respond to Donald Trump.
So what did you think of Kasich, Stephen? I know him, so I'm sort of curious what you thought of him.
So, I mean, what I think is, because he's been, you know, it's been very controversial and having the former, current Republicans like Kasich, and I'm glad, right? For me, this is just like, look, here are the stakes. Before we have Republicans and Democrats, before we have abortion and taxes and regulation and gay marriage or whatever, we have, do we believe in democracy? Do we believe in rule of law? And thank God for people like John Kasich, who are all too rare in the Republican Party, who are willing to say, you know what, I believe in rule of law. I believe in competent governance before I believe in any issue disagreement I may have with Joe Biden. And, you know, and I understand progressives get very upset to have John Kasich and everything get so much time. But to me, that's a very important message, that this transcends any ideological difference. This is an epic election. Really, rule of law, small d democracy is on the ballot. And people need to understand that. So that's, you know, why, for me, I was very glad to have him bring that message from a Republican perspective.
That's a very good point, but I don't know that Kasich actually made that point himself. It would have been nice if he did, or if somebody else made the remarks you just made and tied his presence to the need to rise above political party and ideology and stand up for the rule of law.
But that's why the Lincoln Project exists. And I love what the Lincoln Project said, where, you know, they asked Michelle Obama, Michelle Obama said, people keep saying to me, when they go low, you go high. And she goes, I still think that that's absolutely the case. And that was the comment she made. And then the Lincoln Project came out and said, not a problem. We're going low for you. we're taking that low burden off of you. We're doing all that low work. Michelle, you go as high as you want. I freaking loved it. There's a part of me that wants to give him a knuckle sandwich. I mean, trust me, you know, I mean, she wants to give him honey and tea and I'm sitting there going, barunga, you know, but in a way, Stephen, you should write that. What you just said, you should write that. That should be an op-ed. That should be at theconversation.com. You should write that because it is really important. Val, I have friends who are anti-choice and they're political friends. And they are people that I disagree with on these issues. But where did we find common ground? We found common ground on writing ethics legislation together. We found common ground when we were writing about, you know, getting out the vote. I mean, there were things that we could agree on, which was the democracy with, you know, a little D that we could hold on to with each other. And there were policy differences. But what was so lovely was that we could at least agree on a system that we set up in place so that we could have these discussions in a safe and responsible way. What Donald Trump has taken away is all that sense of safety and security and the ability to disagree without thinking that someone's going to put a knife in your back and they don't want to leave after they lose the election. That is what's so terrifying. So I do think that, Stephen, you need to write that, because I think even if Kasich didn't say it, what you're saying is why he was there. Am I right, Val? I think that was the whole point.
I think you're right. And that's what I think the first night was actually functioning to do. And Michelle Obama talked about the fact that we need to end the chaos. And we do need to go back where two parties can reasonably work together and produce legislation. And that only comes when we return to some kind of civility.
And I'm going to just say something, that before we get to the two parties, you're not going to get a Republican Party for a while. You're going to see is we have to get the progressives and the moderates to talk to each other. It's going to be an intramural fight. It's not going to be between Republicans and Democrats.
No, because we have no centrists at this point.
Right. Well, we do. They're in the Democratic Party. But that doesn't. But I think in a lot of ways, what Michelle Obama was saying isn't just between R's and D's. It was between the D's themselves. And what the D's need to figure out is, where do we find our common ground and how do we get there? Because in the end, this is about what's good for the country.
Arnie, I think isn't one good start to have the rest of the D's and the R's and everybody else take progressives seriously as not anti-American. They're not communists. They're not crazy. They're not shouters. Progressive policies really are worth considering as basic fundamental American values. That's what our Constitution is about.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you there. And I'm just going to tell you that Joe Biden, his policies, at least according to whatever the Democratic Convention has come up with, are more progressive than anything we have seen in ever. So let's put things into perspective. He ain't Barack Obama. He sure as hell ain't Hillary Clinton. And so let's see that they've actually started to move the ball. And I say I helped. That's all I have to say. I've been pushing like crazy. Val Endres, Rhode Island College. Stephen Green, North Carolina State. Good luck to both of you. One online, one in person. Stay healthy, Stephen Green. I don't want to read anything about you. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, everyone. Stick around. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
I am woman, hear me roar in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend, cause I've heard it all before, but I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Oh yes,
welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, I want to remind everyone that we Zoom the day before. So if anything should happen at the convention on Tuesday night, we're not going to talk about it. So you know I go to theconversation.com. Yesterday, we talked about Bella Abzug because it was an article at The Conversation about Bella. And today, we're going to be talking about Black women who aimed for the White House and focused pretty much on Shirley Chisholm, but on a number of other women that also ran. Sharon Austin wrote a piece entitled, "Before Kamala Harris Became Biden's Running Mate, Shirley Chisholm and Other Black Women Aimed for the White House." Professor Austin, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And I'm really glad that the University of Florida has you because I think these are going to be interesting times and you need to change Florida. That's all I have to say. It's your job, Sharon, it's your job. So
thanks,
welcome.
Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. So what do you teach? What when you go into the classroom, what is the sort of raison d'etre for why people take Sharon Austin's classes?
I teach a number of different classes. I've been teaching now, it seems like forever, but 28 years. I started teaching when I was very young. I was ABD. I was a student at the University of Tennessee, and I was teaching my first position at the University of Louisville. And I've been at UF since 2001. I teach courses that deal with American government, public policy, but mostly I emphasize minority politics. This fall, I'll be teaching a class on African-American politics. I've also taught courses on Asian-American politics and Latino politics and policy. I also teach courses that deal with gender. In the spring, I'm teaching a class on women of color and the law, and I teach courses that deal with various aspects of race and gender, but also just generally American government, public policy, and public law.
my audience has heard me tell this story, but because it's we're celebrating the 19th Amendment, and because we're celebrating Kamala, and because we're talking really about the fact that, you know, especially African-American women have really sort of helped to sort of define the Democratic Party. And now for the first time, they're actually able to sort of see themselves on the platform, which is something that they have deserved for a long time. But we don't always get what we want until, unfortunately, people finally begin to realize it. But what I've told my audience is that it was Shirley Chisholm that got me into elective politics. Mm. I'd always been an activist. I'd done low-income advocacy work. I'd done all these things. But it was Shirley Chisholm coming into this very white state of New Hampshire to give a talk to poverty workers. And when she's talking to poverty workers, guess what? 99.9% of them back in the early 80s, we were all girls. Okay, so it was a sea of white females. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about the work that we did, advocating for our clients, you know, the welfare work, what we did with housing, whatever. And then she asked us the question, are you frustrated by what you do? Do you feel like the system doesn't understand the people that you work with and the system that you're trying to sort of improve? And you feel in some ways that you're sort of bound into a system that doesn't give you the flexibility to make change in people's lives. And all of us, you know, if we're all like high-fiving, yeah, exactly right. And so what she said is, she said, then you have an obligation to do something more than do the jobs you're doing now. You have to start thinking about running for elective office. You need to be at the table to bring your experience to the table, to bring their experience to the table. You need to run for school board and city council and state rep. And she said, without you there, they can't fix it. It's not that there's something wrong with them. They just don't know it. Mm-hmm. And you do. And you have an obligation to bring it to the table. And honest to God, everyone in the room disappeared. And it was just Shirley talking to Arnie. Because she was talking to what I felt. I mean, I remember writing letters to Judd Gregg going, what the hell are you doing with the stupid congressional law? I mean, I'm like, I was always complaining, you know, to the higher parks going, you're asking people to make Sophie's choice. Do you understand what it's like to live on welfare? And then I suddenly realized what she was saying is they don't. So you need to be there. Right. And that was Shirley Chisholm in 1984. And Arnie runs for the State House. And Arnie wins a week after she gives birth to her second daughter.
Wow.
So I show up in the legislature with a baby. But this is a part of the Shirley Chisholm story you'll really love, which is why I loved your piece. And that is, my daughter is hearing people asking me to run for governor. It's 1991. And I'm like, this is crazy. We've never done a girl. What are you talking about? I'm poor. I live in the North Country. You know, I've been a backbencher my whole life. Maybe a rabble rouser, but a backbencher. And Shirley had come to do like a, I don't know, it was maybe an Abigail Adams Award or some one of those awards that you give, Susan B. Anthony Award. I think it was the Susan B. Anthony Award. And so we were sitting in the audience as she was there as the keynote speaker. And my daughter, who was my oldest daughter, who was about 9 or 10, is like falling asleep sitting next to me. But all of a sudden she wakes up, because when Shirley Chisholm talks, you don't sleep, you listen. And now Shirley Chisholm is turning to these women and saying, you know, I've always encouraged women to run for office, but I have to beg you to run for where the power is. And the power is governor, the power is US Senate, and the power is president. You have to dream bigger and higher. And Melissa, my oldest daughter, looks at me and pulls on my sleeve, Sharon, and says, Mommy, that lady's talking to you. And I announced that I'm running for governor in 1991, and I was the first female nominee on the Democratic ticket for governor of New Hampshire. Wow. And Shirley Chisholm entered my life twice, and I never got to say thank you, Sharon. Oh. So I want you to understand, I am saying thank you through the airwaves because she made such a difference in my life. So let's talk about the Black women that aim for the White House, because you tell a story about a number of women that I think a lot of people didn't even know about, and there's a reason why, but you give us a sense that they were gutsy, they were strong, and they said, you know what, we may not win, but we're putting ourselves out there.
Exactly. That's exactly the case with women like Shirley Chisholm, who of course sought the Democratic nomination, but other women who mostly ran as independents. And the article mostly focused on women who ran for president, but we didn't get to mention a woman named Charlotta Bass, who was the first Black woman ever to be on a Progressive Party ticket as a running mate, as a vice presidential candidate. These were women that mostly were independents. Many of them had ties to either the Democratic or the Republican Party, but they were mostly independents, and they saw injustices that they wanted to change. And they felt like, just as you said, the only way to bring about any real change is if you run for an office, regardless of whether you think you can win or not, but running for office anyway. And that was the battle that these women had many years ago. And it's also the same battle that a lot of women have even today. There still are a lot of disadvantages for women when they run for office, especially when they run for statewide offices and when they want run for national offices like the president. So they knew that they wanted to bring about change.
Yeah, but one of the things that's so interesting, and you point this out in the article, part of the frustration is convincing your own group, your own people, that they have to believe in you too. It's not just that they can't raise money. They go into these like fabulous African-American, you know, communities and say, vote for me. I'm going to work with you. I believe in you. And they look at you and they go, we love you, but you're not going to win. We love you, but it's not. So in a lot of ways, they can't dream it.
Yep,
and if they can't dream it, they're not going to support it. And that's another reason why people like AOC and Kamala and Shirley Chisholm, we need to see women try. But in the end, we also have to be able to say they can succeed. And that is such a long haul from the trying of all these African-American women to finally having Kamala Harris in 2020 on a ballot.
Right. And that was exactly the case for Shirley Chisholm in 1972. She didn't get a lot of support from the African-American community, and a lot of that was based on sexism. A lot of Black political men wanted to see a man running to seek the Democratic nomination. They didn't want a woman. And that's one of the sort of the ugly secrets in the Black community that we don't like to talk about, is the fact that there is sexism in our community, as there's sexism in every community. So she didn't get universal support from African Americans, and even though she was one of the founding members of the Congressional Black Caucus, some of the male members of the caucus were very much opposed to her because they felt she couldn't win. She would only take some of the attention away from George McGovern. In the end, she would hurt the Democratic Party, and she would pretty much make it assure that President Nixon would be reelected, which eventually we know that he was, but not necessarily because of anything that she said or did. But one of my favorite quotes of hers, and I know I'm probably not saying it right, but she always says that, used to say, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. She was determined to be heard. So even if people wouldn't accept her or embrace her or support her, nevertheless, she was going to be there fighting to get a seat at the table. And she knew that even though necessarily she may not have gotten the kind of seat at the table that she wanted, eventually someone would. And so I can only imagine that she now, regardless of the outcome of the election in November, whether or not the Biden-Harris ticket wins or loses, she's somewhere smiling in heaven just right. to be able to see a Black woman in this position. She and so many others like her.
So when I ran in 1992, I lost. I won the primary, but I lost the general election. It was the year of Ross Perot. So I'll just let me explain that to you. So I was running with Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton had Ross Perot. Unfortunately, I did not. So Clinton wins my state and Arnie loses the state. And I actually got a higher percentage than Bill. So go figure. Anyway, but then in 1996, the next woman ever to run and to win the nomination wins. Okay. And I remember going to her inauguration and sitting next to the conservative reporter for the very conservative paper called The Union Leader. And I remember thinking, you can't emote Arnie because you're sitting next to him and he's watching you as you're watching this woman get sworn in for a position you wanted. And he turns to me at the end of the inauguration and he says, so how hard was it, Arnie? And all of a sudden my eyes welled with tears. And I said, harder than I thought. But then I looked at him and I said, you know, John DeStazo, I said, politics is a lot like life. Some of us get to open doors and others get to walk through them. And that's what Shirley Chisholm is going to be smiling about, because she opened so many doors. She opened a door for me, not just for Kamala, but how many me's that she never met, because she was a role model for us. Her courage was a role model for us. I mean, I think that's what people don't even understand, is that you see her and you think, well, she ran for president. There hasn't been an African-American woman president. And then I'm thinking, no, but there's been the first woman to run for governor, this little white girl from Northern New Hampshire who was inspired by her. So in a lot of ways, that's another reason why you bring the folding chair.
Right. And she also inspired me, because I teach a course on Black women's politics that I'll be teaching in the spring. I first taught this course over 20 years ago at another university. And I remember when I was trying to develop the course, I was in a very, I guess, mainstream kind of conservative political science department. I was the only Black faculty member, one of less than a handful of women on the faculty. And I wanted to do research on Black women and teach a course on Black women, because I had a lot of Black female students who wanted to see a course similar to this, because I had talked about this in my African-American politics class. And I remember one of my senior colleagues saying to me, well, nobody cares about that. Nobody wants to know about Black women. That's not really political science. So she inspired me, because now you can't say that. Now you see that there's so many women other than Senator Harris, but so many Black women who are politically active, whether they're running for office, whether they're teaching like I am, or whether they're doing other activities, even if it's just someone who's registering people to vote or even voting herself. She shows that Black women in politics, that is something that is indeed important. And that's something that people should want to know more about. And then also I want to quickly mention before I forget, one of my good friends, her name is Evelyn Simeon, and she's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. She wrote a book entitled Historic First. And she has chapters on Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Shirley Chisholm. And she talks about the impact of Shirley Chisholm in influencing later political candidates. And it's a very interesting book, because it talks about President Obama's campaign and also Hillary Clinton's campaigns, and the way that they also were influenced by Shirley Chisholm. So even though she didn't win in 1972, she influenced so many people who eventually did run for major offices and did win.
Well, you know, I keep thinking, what is so interesting to me is that, all right, so Arnie grew up on Long Island in a white environment. She goes to St. Olaf College, this Norwegian Lutheran school. She lives in Vermont. And yet when I think of the women that have influenced me politically, it was Barbara Jordan. It was Shirley Chisholm. And I think what it is that they had such courage. I wanted their courage. I wanted their ability to look at power and say, you can't defeat me. You're not going to intimidate. I always tell the story about my mother. When I called her up to tell her that I was running for governor, my Italian mother says to me, you can't. And I said, what do you mean you can't? You'll embarrass the family. So Shirley was important to me, because she didn't care about embarrassing anyone. She was seeking justice. And justice wasn't about embarrassment. It had to be fought for. And so I think that the great quote that you have in your article about Jesse Jackson saying that the hands that have picked cotton are now going to pick a president, mm-hmm. you know, and that is so important. And now the president that they get to pick, or the vice president they get to pick, is them.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, I included that quote because my parents grew up in the Mississippi Delta, and they're both deceased now. But my parents were Mississippi sharecroppers. So I come from generations of Mississippi sharecroppers, people who actually did pick cotton. So that was always one of my favorite quotes from Jesse Jackson, hands that once picked cotton, because I think about my own family background and the experiences that my parents had growing up in the segregated South in Mississippi. My father was born in 1938. My mother was born in 1940, and the type of conditions that they had to live through. And I remember even hearing about my parents talk about the 1960s and when they were marching, and even seeing some of my aunts going to participate in marches many years later, after, I guess, the height of the modern movement. But nevertheless, seeing them still go to march just to remember the way things used to be. So that is also something that has a huge impact on me.
Absolutely. Ken, you want to weigh in?
Yes, thanks. I just want to add something. To hear you talking about Barbara Jordan and Shirley Chisholm and Arnie feeling like she was more influenced by Black women leaders, it just made me think one thing about these women and other people that really excite me is their humanity. They're not on a pedestal bellowing about ideology or good guys and bad guys, you know, you're hateful. They are talking from the heart. They see everybody as a fellow human being, and every human being is entitled to equal dignity and respect. And they just raise these human values. Frankly, Michelle Obama had some of that same quality in her tone last night. You know,
it was universal. It was so universal.
It's authentic. Exactly. It's universal. I've told Arnie, Sharon, I visited the Matamoros immigrant camp on the other side of the border in Mexico, the other side from Brownsville. These are asylum seekers who were trying to come to the U.S., and we just didn't even let them
Let them across the border, exactly.
This country, and they're left with nothing. makeshift camps, really. And I met a lot of these people while I was there, and a similar kind of humanity, just talking to them, the dignity. They're not bitter about their lot in life, which they faced a lot of terrible things. They thank God that they're still here. And I mean, they literally say, gracias a Dios, that they have the opportunity. Maybe they won't get asylum. Maybe they won't make it in the U.S., but they're going to keep on going one foot in front of the other.
But maybe it's that they appreciate the fight.
Beautiful, yeah. But the spirit of this warmth, this deep humanity, just really, I think it's a powerful, powerful force. And women like Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan just embody that.
Well, and I'm sure you saw the Democratic convention last night, and that's why she knocked it out of the park. There is just no question about it. And she did go high. And she reminded us why going high is so important, because high is about justice. High is about fairness. High is about loving your brother. High, I mean, that's what high is. I mean, when they keep saying, you know, well, we need to get into the dirt. No, no, no. You want to be where high is because it's what you believe. So one quick question, though, as I was reading it about the other women who have run. They ran as independents. They also ran as communists. They ran as, what I think is so interesting for me is that they couldn't find a foothold in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. But they didn't necessarily think that that was the only way forward. And it's interesting because before I ran, there were two other women that had run for office. I was the first woman to run on a major party platform. Mm-hmm. But before Arnie, there had been a communist and there had been a libertarian. So it's fascinating. This is where these women started. They didn't start because the mainstream parties didn't acknowledge their existence. So they had to find another way to push open the door.
Right. The overwhelming majority of them ran as independents. And they did so because they pretty much had to, because the Democratic Party, during the time that many of these women were running, was the party that consisted largely of a lot of conservative Democrats who didn't want civil rights, who were very much opposed to that. And although with our perception today of the Communist Party, we think of it as being really, really negative and un-American, but nevertheless, the Communist Party was very progressive. And a lot of African-Americans chose to join the Communist Party because they were very supportive of civil rights, whereas the Democratic Party at the time and also the Republican Party wasn't. So many of these women ran as independents because that's where they found their voice. Some of them even founded their own independent political parties because some of the existing ones didn't promote the type of ideals that they wanted to promote. So again, that shows just the importance of independent politics in this country. Even though independent political parties have never really been all that successful in getting people in office and having them win, right, they nevertheless have served a major role because people who have not felt appreciated or wanted in the major political parties have always been able to turn to independent parties and to be able to promote their platforms in that way.
So before I let you go, Sharon, what do you think of this moment? Is this a tipping point? Are we coming to grips with our history of racism? Are we beginning to acknowledge the diversity of this country and that we need to represent the diversity of this country? I go back and I keep thinking, is this like gay marriage? You know, it was no, no, no. And then all of a sudden it was yes. And then the floodgates opened and now everyone sort of changed. You know, it's like now, it's like, oh, we were never against gay marriage. I'm like, yeah, right. You know, and I'm wondering if it's possible that this race conversation and the conversation we're having about going high, for example, that are we at a tipping point? Do you feel the difference now than having what you've studied over the last 30 years?
See a positive difference in the sense that, especially since the death of George Floyd, there have been, unfortunately, other racialized murders. There have been other examples of police brutality, and people have reacted in different ways. But one of the things that I'm impressed by is that I see such a multiracial crowd of people coming together to protest racial injustice, and I've never seen it on this large a scale before during my lifetime. So that I'm encouraged by. But just keep in mind, we were having these same discussions when President Obama was elected. People were wondering if this meant that there was a new post-racial society. And now we can see that there were some positive things that resulted, but also some negative things. And if our society still is not as progressive as we'd like for it to be. But I am encouraged by the number of progressive candidates who are running for office, who are winning elections in Congress, who are defeating incumbents even, who've been in office for many, many years. Recently, there was a major upset in Missouri of a black family, the Clay family, which was sort of like political icons.
And institutions, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I am seeing that people have the courage to protest, and also people have the courage to run. So despite whatever obstacles will be placed in the way of candidates, they still are running for office.
And I want to remind everyone that the biggest obstacle you have is yourself. Check yourself out before you even start. And I think one of the hardest things is to convince people it's okay. You can risk it. It's okay. I speak to women all the time about running for office, and I remind them that most of them that will run will lose. Will lose. But that's not a reason not to run. Absolutely. And that's so, so important. And I think, again, that's where you want to remind people that it's hard, and there may be a lot of people around you, but the person you have to convince first is yourself. You know, and I think that that's really the essential, absolutely essential. Yes,
sure.
Ken.
A question first, I'm sorry. You were talking about, we all thought it might be the turning point when Barack Obama was elected president. I certainly was one of those who was hopeful and dreaming that, but it didn't happen. And I wonder to some extent, I mean, partly it's because he had this horrible economic catastrophe that he had to deal with, but the next president, Biden and Harris, are going to have to deal with also a terrible pandemic and everything. But Obama is sometimes criticized for having bailed out Wall Street and not bailed out Main Street and not dealing with the Barrio and Martin Luther King Boulevard, just Wall Street. And maybe that could be a lesson for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who are not known for being on the left of the Democratic Party, that speaking to really the change that we're hoping will happen is something that they should actually put into action.
Actually, Sharon, you know what I want to do? I want to put Barack Obama on a couch. I want to sit next to him and say, so let's talk about the mistakes of 2008 and 2012. What would you do differently? Because I think in a lot of ways, and he keeps saying it over and over again, this is not 2008. This is not 2012. It's almost like he wants to backstop and say, don't you go back to where I was, because where I was will absolutely not fix it. In part, maybe I brought Donald Trump to the table, unfortunately, because I responded to Wall Street and didn't respond to Main Street. But now with the pandemic has exposed is every piece of rot that's out there and all the mythology about who we are. And now that we know it and we have to confront it, you can't go back. I won't give you a chance to. And I think that that's what's going to be really exciting. Sharon Austin, take care of yourself. Be healthy. Have a good academic year at the University of Florida. Thank you for bringing Shirley Chisholm and all my Shirley Chisholm stories to the table. I'm going to blame you for that, but thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's terrific. All right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. And again, we have a Democratic convention. Day two is tonight because we're Zooming on Tuesday, and we'll talk more about it tomorrow. Ciao.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.